So, imagine a registered rep at a mid-sized broker-dealer. Let's call him Dave.
Okay, Dave.
Yeah, Dave. And Dave is having just a great quarter. He's bringing in assets, doing trades, getting high fives from the branch manager.
Right.
And one day, he helps this elderly client move some money around, fills out the forms, checks the boxes, but he forgets to get one single signature on a conflict of interest disclosure.
Oh, man.
Yeah, and he thinks nothing of it. But 2 years later, the market dips, the client loses money, and their estate attorney starts digging through the paperwork.
And they find
Exactly. That one missing signature cost Dave his job, triggers a massive FINRA sweep, a multi-million dollar fine, and it just ruins the firm's reputation.
Yeah, because the compliance manual isn't just, a book of suggestions.
Right. It's a minefield, one wrong step, and boom.
And the scary part is Dave probably thought he was doing the right thing. He was just focused on the market, not the actual rules.
Exactly. Which brings us to the core of what we're tackling today. But before we get in the weeds, this deep dive is brought to you by CertFuel.
Highly recommend them.
Yeah, if you're taking the Series 24, they've got this full course with adaptive study quizzes, smart flashcards, and unlimited practice exams weighted just like the real test. Check it out at CertFuel.com.
It's a lifesaver.
Truly. So our mission today, we're zeroing in on function three of the Series 24 exam, recommendations and disclosures. And our goal is to not just recognize these rules, but like deeply learn and retain them.
Right, because if you go into the exam expecting everything to be black and white, like a traffic camera where you run a red light and get a ticket, you're going to fail.
Yeah, the rules completely shift depending on who the customer is, what they're buying, and how the firm gets paid.
So context is everything.
Context is everything. So to make this stick, especially for my ADHD brain, we're going to use some recurring characters. We need to picture the actual people walking into Dave's firm.
I love this. Let's do it.
Okay, first up, we have Retail Rita. Rita is an everyday natural person. She's a graphic designer, investing for her family, trying to build a college fund.
So she represents the classic retail investor, the person who relies entirely on the broker's expertise.
Right. Next, we have Institutional Irene. Now, Irene manages a pension fund with over $50 million in assets.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah, she's got Bloomberg terminals, a team of analysts, and she understands derivatives better than the brokers calling her.
So she is a highly sophisticated counterparty. The regulators basically assume Irene can fend for herself.
Exactly. And finally, the wild card, Careless Carl.
Oh boy. Careless Carl.
Carl is a registered rep who means well, but he is fundamentally sloppy. He hates compliance. He cuts corners. He was basically a walking violation.
Every compliance principal has a careless Carl, and your job on the Series 24 is to basically anticipate what Carl's going to break before he breaks it.
Right. So Rita and Irene walk into the lobby. Carl walks up to them. Before he can even think about pitching a mutual fund, what's the very first regulatory toll booth he hits?
Form CRS, the Customer Relationship Summary.
Right, the gateway document.
Yeah, and it's fascinating because it was born out of the SEC just being so frustrated. Firms used to hand retail clients these massive phone book-sized disclosures full of legalese.
And nobody read them.
Exactly, nobody read them. So they mandated Form CRS as a plain English summary. It's like a mandatory dating profile you have to hand over before the relationship starts.
Okay, so it covers services, fees, conflicts, disciplinary history.
Yeah.
But this is a huge exam trap, right? The wording.
Massive trap. The rule says Form CRS must be delivered to a retail investor. But later, Reg BI uses the term retail customer.
Okay, wait, think about this for a second. An investor versus a customer. They sound exactly the same.
They do, but legally, they're totally different phases. A retail investor for Form CRS is just a natural person seeking services.
Ah, seeking.
Right. They haven't bought anything, no recommendation has been made.
So if Rita just walks in and says, "Hey, I'm thinking about transferring my account here. What do you guys do?" She is instantly a retail investor.
Instantly. And Carl has to hand her the Form CRS right then and there, like before or at the earliest of recommending an account, placing an order, or opening the account.
Wow, okay. So when does she become a customer?
The second Carl makes an actual recommendation, like, "Hey, Rita, based on your goals, I think you should buy this mutual fund." Boom, now she's a customer under Reg BI.
Got it. Now, you said the SEC hated the old phone book disclosures. So what's to stop the legal department from making Form CRS 50 pages long?
Strict physical page limits. If you're a standalone broker-dealer, it cannot exceed 2 pages.
Only 2 pages.
Just two. And if you're a dual registrant, meaning a broker-dealer and an investment advisor, you get 4 pages.
That is brilliant. It forces them to put the most important stuff up front, So Carl hands Rita her 2 pages. How long do they have to keep a record of that?
6 years. 6 years after the record is created or amended, and the most recent 2 years have to be readily accessible.
6 years. Good to know. Okay, so Carl got Form CRS out of the way. Can he recommend a trade now?
Nope. He still has to do KYC. Know your customer.
Okay, KYC. Gathering the essential facts.
Right, at account opening and during maintenance. It's not just about risk tolerance, it's about operational control.
Like what?
Like who actually has the legal authority to move this money?
Okay, here's a direct question for the listener. Let's say a guy sits down with Carl, hands him a tax ID for a family trust, and says, I want a trade. Carl just opens the account without verifying if the guy is actually the trustee. He hasn't recommended a single stock yet. Did Carl commit a violation?
Yes, an immediate severe KYC violation.
See, that trips people up. You'd think the violation only happens when a bad trade is made.
Right, but the firm is the gatekeeper. If you don't verify authority, you failed KYC before the first dollar is even invested.
Okay, so Carl survives KYC. He knows Rita is a retail mom, moderate risk. He knows Irene is an institutional whale with $50 million. Now he wants to pitch a slightly aggressive mutual fund to both of them. Same fund, same day.
And this is where the regulatory highway literally splits into two lanes.
Yeah, so institutional Irene gets the suitability standard. Retail Rita gets regulation best interest or Reg BI.
Exactly.
Let's do the suitability lane for Irene first. What are the three obligations there?
Okay, first is reasonable basis suitability.
Meaning, is this fund suitable for anyone in the general public?
Yes. The firm has to actually understand the product. You can't pitch a complex derivative if your own firm doesn't know how it makes money.
Makes sense. Number two.
Customer-specific suitability. Is it suitable for this specific client based on their age, risk, all that?
And three.
Quantitative suitability. Even if every trade is fine on its own, is the overall series of trades excessive? This is what outlaws churning.
Churning, right.
Right.
But wait, Irene has $50 million and a team of analysts. Does Carl really need to hold her hand and do a customer-specific check?
He doesn't, thanks to the institutional exemption. But she has to meet two criteria. One, the firm believes she can evaluate risk independently. And two, she has to affirmatively indicate she is exercising independent judgment.
Basically saying, I hear your pitch, Carl, but I'm making my own choices.
Exactly.
Exam trap time. If Irene waives that, can Carl just pitch her total garbage? Since she waived her protection.
I love this question. No, absolutely not. Because she only waived the customer-specific obligation.
Oh.
Carl is still bound by reasonable basis and quantitative suitability. The product still has to be fundamentally sound,
yeah.
And he still can't churn her account.
Okay, that makes sense. Let's look at Retail Rita. She's in the Reg BI lane. This is a much higher standard, right? Act in her best interest.
Much higher. And it applies to securities, strategies, account types, and rollovers.
Oh, so even just suggesting she roll her 401k into an IRA falls into Reg BI.
Yes. And Reg BI has 4 component obligations. Disclosure, care, conflict of interest, and compliance.
Let's focus on care. How is the care obligation different from the old customer-specific suitability?
Cost. It all comes down to cost.
Explain that.
Under the old rules, if you had 2 identical funds, but one charged a 1% fee and the other charged 4%, a broker could legally sell the 4% fund because it was still suitable. But under Reg BI's care obligation, Carl must explicitly consider costs and reasonably available alternatives.
So if he pitches the 4% fund and ignores the 1% one without a crazy good reason,
yay,
he violated Reg BI.
Exactly.
Now, what about the conflict of interest obligation? They have to disclose or mitigate conflicts. But wait, I'm going to break the fourth wall here. Eliminate.
Yes.
Some things have to be eliminated entirely, right?
Right. You cannot just disclose certain things. Firms have to completely eliminate sales contests, quotas, and bonuses tied to specific securities within a limited time.
So if a fund says, hey, Carl, sell 5 million of our stock this month and win a trip to Hawaii, his manager can't just put that in the fine print.
No, because the psychological incentive is too dangerous. Disclosure is useless there. It must be eliminated. Now, overall gross production grids are okay.
Like if he just makes a higher percentage for bringing in more revenue across the board, that's fine.
Yeah, general incentives are fine.
Okay, let's talk pricing.
Okay.
Carl gets the trades done. How does the firm charge for this without getting greedy? The 5% policy.
The 5% policy. The biggest misconception is that this is a safe harbor. It is not. It is merely a guideline.
Right, it's like a speed limit in a snowstorm.
Mm-hmm.
The sign says 65, but if there's 2 feet of snow and you're doing 65, that's reckless driving.
Perfect analogy. If Carl charges a 4.5% markup on a highly liquid Apple stock, that price is unfair. The market is too efficient. It's reckless driving.
But if he's hunting down a rare municipal bond for Irene, and it takes 3 days and the firm takes inventory risk, maybe 5.5% is perfectly fair.
Exactly. It's holistic.
Okay, another exam trap. What if Carl knows 4.5% is a ripoff, so he prints it in a giant bold font on the confirmation? He tells Rita, I am ripping you off. Does disclosure cure the unfair price?
No. Never. Disclosure does not cure an unfair price. You can't just tell the victim you're doing it.
Okay, what about net transactions, where the firm is a principal? They buy a stock for $100, hold it in inventory, and sell it to Rita for $102. The spread is embedded.
Right, it's an opaque fee. So FINRA has strict consent rules. For retail Rita, the firm needs written consent on an order-by-order basis prior to every single net trade.
That's a lot of friction. Every single time.
Every time. But for institutional Irene, she gets a one-time negative consent letter. Basically, if she doesn't object, her silence is consent.
What about retail debt markups? Bonds.
This is a newer rule for transparency. If the firm buys a corporate or agency bond and sells it to Rita as a principal on the same day, a same-day offsetting trade, the confirmation has to show four things.
The markup in total dollars, the percentage of prevailing market price, the exact execution time to the second, and a hyperlink to trace.
You got it. But only if it's the same day. If they hold it overnight, taking market risk, the rule doesn't trigger the same way.
Got it. All right, let's move to the ultimate test pattern, the breakpoint sale.
Oh, this is tested constantly.
Yeah. So mutual funds have volume discounts or breakpoints. Say Rita has $98,000. The next fee discount is at $100,000. Carl just books the $98,000 trade, keeps his mouth shut, and gets a bigger commission. What three things did he fail to check?
He failed to check rights of accumulation, or ROA, a letter of intent, or LOI, and combined purchases.
Let's break those down. ROA means checking her existing holdings, right?
Yeah.
If she already has $5,000 in that fund family, she's actually at $103,000. She deserves the discount.
Exactly. And if she doesn't have existing holdings, Carl should have told her about an LOI. A letter of intent is a 13-month commitment to reach that breakpoint.
13 months. Lock that number in. And combined purchases means checking if her spouse or kids have accounts to aggregate.
Yes.
Now, what if Carl's just an idiot? He didn't maliciously try to steal from Rita. He was just lazy and didn't check. Is that a defense?
No defense at all. A breakpoint sale violation does not require proof of intent to deceive. Negligence is enough.
Intent is irrelevant.
Wow.
Okay, let's switch gears. What if Rita is tired of answering the phone and just wants Carl to run the portfolio? She wants to give him a discretionary account.
The regulatory barrier here is huge. It's basically handing over legal proxy. The firm needs three distinct writings before a single trade happens.
Three writings?
Yes. Written authorization from the customer, written acceptance by the firm, and principal approval of each individual order promptly after it's entered.
So if Rita calls from a cruise ship during a market crash and yells, sell everything, you have full discretion. Carl can't do it.
No, oral authorization is totally invalid for full discretion.
But wait, what if she says, buy 100 shares of Apple today, you pick the best time and price?
Ah, that's the time and price exception. Carl doesn't need the three writings for that because Rita specified the asset, action, and quantity.
But how long does that last? Can he wait 3 weeks for a dip?
No, it is strictly good for one single business day. If the bell rings and he hasn't bought it, the authorization vanishes.
Good to know. Okay, if he does have full discretion, the principal has to watch for churning, turnover rates, and cost equity ratios.
Right. An annualized turnover rate of 6 or higher is presumed churning, and if the cost equity ratio approaches 20%, meaning she needs a 20% return just to pay Carl's fees, alarms should be going off.
And if they ignore it, the SEC sees it as systemic fraud, not just a rule violation.
Exactly.
All right, let's flip it again. Rita takes the wheel. She wants to day trade with heavy margin.
High risk. If a firm promotes day trading, they have to deliver a bleak risk disclosure individually before opening the account.
And they have to make a formal written determination that day trading is appropriate for her, right? Or get her to agree in writing not to day trade.
Correct. But here is the massive pattern interrupt for anyone who studied older material. Sirens going off. The old pattern day trader rule. The $25,000 minimum equity requirement. It was repealed effective June 4th, 2026.
Oh, wow. So if $25,000 is an answer choice on the exam, It's a trap.
It's a huge trap. The industry moved to an intraday margin deficit framework. The system dynamically monitors the account during the day.
But what if a stock ticks down a penny? Does she get a margin call instantly?
No, there's a de minimis buffer. It's the lesser of 5% of equity or $1,000.
And if she blows past that and doesn't pay the deficit by the fifth business day,
the firm slaps a 90-day restriction on the account.
Does that freeze the account?
Not entirely. It just restricts new risk. No new short positions, no new debit balances for 90 days. She's grounded.
Grounded. Got it. Let's do some rapid-fire account maintenance stuff. Disclosures. The annual stack.
Okay. Margin risk and SIPC info are delivered at opening and annually. BrokerCheck is at least once a calendar year.
What about extended hours trading?
Only once, before the very first after-hours trade.
Okay. And the pre-dispute arbitration agreement?
The client has to get a signed copy within 30 days.
Can that agreement ban Rita from joining a class action lawsuit?
Never. Class actions are explicitly carved out of finer arbitration.
Awesome. What if Carl's old mentor retires to a beach? Can the firm still pay him commissions?
Only if there was a written contract signed while he was still actively registered. And only for past production. He can't pitch new trades from the beach.
What if Rita travels to Europe and wants the firm to hold her mail?
For convenience. Maximum of 3 months. Any longer requires a documented reason, like a military deployment or medical issue.
What if Carl wants to set up a monthly bank draft to fund her IRA?
He needs express written authorization. And the firm must keep that record for 3 years after the authorization expired.
After it expires. That's a sneaky timeline.
Yeah, it is.
What if Carl wants to pitch a penny stock, an OTC equity?
The firm must review current financials first. If the company is a delinquent filer, the firm actually has to investigate why they failed to file. You can't just shrug it off.
Okay, last one before the recap. Direct participation programs, DPPs.
Very complex, illiquid. The firm has to get specific info directly from the participant net worth, tax status, liquid income, to make sure they can actually use the tax benefits and absorb the risk.
Man. Okay, so who is watching Carl do all this? The principal's paranoia.
The supervisory three-step. Recognize, investigate, escalate.
Recognize the anomaly. Investigate by pulling the history and interviewing Carl. And escalate to compliance or legal.
But here's the trap. If the principal does all that flawlessly, yells at Carl, fixes the problem, but doesn't write anything down.
It's a massive violation.
Right. If it isn't in writing, it didn't happen.
What about the trusted contact person, the TCP? If Rita gets dementia and her TCP daughter says, don't wire that money, buy treasury bonds instead, can the principal do it?
Absolutely not. The TCP is informational only. They cannot authorize trades.
And finally, suspicious activity reports.
Tarsus.
If a client brings in $9,000 in cash every day.
Structuring. Money laundering. The firm files a SAR, and the absolute rule, do not tip off a customer, it's a federal crime.
Okay. Take a breath. We made it. Let's do the rapid fire exam recap.
REGBI is for retail natural persons. Suitability is for institutional.
Form CRS is 2 pages standalone, 4 pages dual. Delivered before or at the earliest of a recommendation, order, or opening.
Institutional exemption for customer-specific suitability requires firm belief in capability plus the customer's affirmative indication.
Breakpoint violations happen just below the threshold. Check ROA, LOI, which is 13 months, and combined purchases. Intent is not required.
Discretionary accounts need 3 writings. Customer, firm, principal, time and price discretion lasts 1 day.
Day trading. The $25,000 PDT rule is gone. Repealed June 2026. It's an intraday margin deficit test now with a 90-day restriction for failures.
Annual disclosures, margin, SIPC, broker check, arbitration copy within 30 days.
And supervision is recognize, investigate, escalate, document everything. TCP cannot execute trades.
You nailed it.
So think about everything we just covered, from form CRS to day trading to suspicious activity. What stands out to you?
If you really look at it, the SEC and FINRA have basically tried to automate trust. They know investors can't evaluate risk perfectly, and they know reps like Carl will cut corners. So every rule, every 2-page limit, every 13-month window is a hardwired substitute for blind faith.
Which brings up a crazy thought experiment for everyone studying this. Right now, this whole system relies on a human principal watching a human broker. But as trading gets faster, and as AI starts generating the actual investment recommendations, how does reasonable diligence change when the broker sitting across from Rita is an AI?
That is the regulatory war of tomorrow, for sure.
Keep grinding, visualize the rules, and we'll see you on the next deep dive.